Blog Talk Radio. Talk about tonight, there's a whole bunch of stuff that came up during the week, and excuse me here. Okay, for those of you, well, I know we didn't discuss this last week because it just came up this week. Actually, it came up in the last couple of days. The myths about the detention bill. Okay, posted by
Salon.com.
And war on terror is a fraud while Americans shocked and Constitution was shredded. This was pretty good.
There's
a few other things here I wanted to. I didn't talk. This came up on the 16th, which was.
Well, let's go into the one that you just mentioned on the terrorism bill.
Yeah, I can do that. But 50 economic numbers from 2011, they're almost too crazy to believe. I really wanted to.
Well, we can do that afterwards.
Well, I thought that was more important because what happened really is that Obama signed. He was supposed to. I don't know if he was supposed to veto it or not, but he's such a fraud. Nobody can believe anything he says anyway. Forget that one. We're not going to go to that one. That's the wrong one. Oh Lord, help us all. Lila, don't push it.
Well, go ahead. Just go to the.
It. Okay, but we're moving here. We're moving right along. Okay. Okay, here we go. Salon.com put up, the three myths about the detention bill, which was just signed this week, or actually last week. And I wanted to talk about that briefly. Up here. You don't, see, that takes a drain, yeah. Condemnation of President Obama is intense and growing as a result of his announced intent to sign into law the indefinite detention bill embedded in the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act. These denunciations come not only from the nation's leading civil liberties and human rights groups, but also from the pro-Obama New York Times editorial, which today was a scathing editorial describing Obama's stance as a complete political cave-in, one that reinforces the impression of a fumbling president and lamenting that the bill has so many other objectionable aspects that we can't go into them all, as well as from vocal Obama supporters such as Andrew Sullivan, who wrote yesterday that this episode is another sign that his campaign pledge to be vigilant about civil liberties and the war on terror was a lie. Damage control White House allied groups are now trying to ride the rescue to the rescue with attacks against the ACLU and dismissive belittling of the bill's dangers. For that reason, it's very worthwhile to briefly examine and debunk the three principal myths being spread by supporters of this bill, and to do so very simply by citing the relevant provisions of the bill as well as the relevant passage of the original 2011 authorization to use military force. So that everyone can judge for themselves what this bill actually includes. This is all above and beyond the evidence I assembled in writing about in another article that this guy wrote. Myth one, the bill does not codify indefinite detention. Section 1021 of the Defense Act governs, as its title says, authority of the armed forces to detain covered persons pursuant to the AUMF. The first provision explicitly affirms that the authority of the president includes the authority of the armed forces of the United States to detain covered persons. The next section defines what covered persons are, those who can be detained by the military, as a person who was a part or substantially supported Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. With regard to those covered individuals, this is the power vested in the president by the next section. Person of disposition under war, it says position of a person under the law of war as described and subsection may include the following. A detention under the law of war without trial until the end of the hostilities authorized by the authorization for use of military force.
It simply cannot be any clearer within the confines of the English language that this bill codifies the power of indefinite detention. It expressly empowers the president with regard to anyone accused of the acts in Section B to detain them without trial until the end of hostilities. That is the very definition of indefinite detention, and that statute could not be clearer that it vests this power. Anyone claiming this bill does not codify indefinite detention should be forced to explain how they can claim in light of this crystal clear provision. It is true, as I've pointed out repeatedly, that both Bush and Obama administrations have argued that the 2001 AUMF implicitly already vests the power of indefinite detention in the president. In post-9/11, deferential courts have largely accepted that view, allowed them to eavesdrop on Americans without the warrants required by law. That's why the NDAA can state that nothing is intended to expand the 2001 AUMF while achieving exactly that, because the executive and judicial interpretation being given in the 2001 AUMF is already so much broader than its language provides. But this is the first time this power of indefinite detention is being expressly codified by statute. There's not a word about detention powers in the 2001 AUMF. Indeed, as the ACLU and the HRW both point out, It's the first time such powers are being codified in a statute since the McCarthy era Internal Security Act of 1950, about which I wrote yesterday.
Myth number two, the bill does not expand the scope. The bill does not expand the scope of the war on terror as defined by the 2001 AUMF. This myth is very easily dispensed with. The scope of the war as defined by the original 2001 AUMF was, at least relative to the new bill, quite specific and narrow. Here the full extent of the power of the original is granted. In general, the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attack that occurred on September 11, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or purposes. Well, under the clear language of the 2001 AUMF, the president's authorization to use force was explicitly confined to those who helped perpetrate the 9/11 attack, harbored the perpetrators. That's it. Now look at how much broader it is in regard to who can be targeted. There's only three things to do it, but this is critical. The covered persons under this new plan are. A person who planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attack that occurred on September 11th, or harbored those responsible for those. A person who was a part or substantially supported the Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States, including any person who has committed a belligerent act or has directly supported such hostilities in aid of such enemy forces. Basically, a restatement of what they just said, but Section 2 is a brand new addition. It allows the president to target not only those who helped perpetrate 9/11 or those who harbored them, but also anyone who substantially supports such groups and or associated forces. Those are extremely vague terms, subject to wild and obvious levels of abuse.
Does that mean if you sent a letter to someone in Palestine, interpreted as support?
Yeah.
It says
substantially statutory escalation of the war on terror and the president's powers under it. And it occurs more than 10 years after 9/11, which Osama bin Laden dead, and with the U.S. government boasting that virtually all Al-Qaeda leaders have been eliminated, an original organization, the one accused of perpetrating 9/11 attack, rendered inoperable. So who were they aiming this at? And it is true that both the Bush and Obama administration have long been arguing the original AUMF should be broadly interpreted so as to authorize forces against much larger scope of individuals, despite the complete absence of such language in that original AUMF. That's how the Obama administration justifies its ongoing bombing of Yemen, Somalia, and its killing of people based on claims that they support groups that did not even exist at the time of 9/11. And they argue these new posts, 9/11 groups, were targeting our associated forces of Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
Individuals are killing substantially support those groups. But this is the first time that Congress has codified that wildly expanded definition of the enemy in war on terror, and all anyone has to do to see that it is compare the old AUMF with the new one.
Myth three, U.S. citizens are exempted from this new bill. This is simply false, at least when expressed so definitively and without caveats. The bill is purposely muddled on this issue, which is what is enabling the falsehood. There are two separate indefinite military detention provisions in this bill. The first section, 1021, authorizes indefinite detention for the broad definition of covered persons discussed above in the prior point. And that section does provide that nothing in this section shall be construed to affect existing law or authorities relating to the detention of United States citizens, lawful residents, aliens of the United States, or any other person who are captured or arrested in the United States. So that section contains a disclaimer regarding an intention to expand detention powers for U.S. citizens, but does so only for the powers vested by that specific section. More important, the exclusion appears to extend only to U.S. citizens captured or arrested in the United States, meaning that the powers indefinite detention vested by the section apply to U.S. citizens captured anywhere abroad. There is some grammatical vagueness on this point, but at the very least, there is a viable argument that the detention power in this section applies to U.S. citizens captured abroad. But the next section, 1022, is a different story. That section specifically deals with a smaller category of people than the broad group covered by 1021, namely, anyone whom the president determines is a member of or a part of Al-Qaeda or an associated force and participated in the course of planning or carrying out an attack or an attempted attack against the United States or its coalition partners. For those persons, Section A not only authorizes but requires, absent a presidential waiver, that they be held in a military custody pending deposition under the law of war. The section title is Military Custody for Foreign Al-Qaeda Terrorists, but the definition of who it covers does not include U.S. citizens. Does not exclude U.S. citizens or include any requirements of foreignness. Yep. Where did that go? Oh, here it is. The section 1022 does not claim the broad disclaimer regarding U.S. citizens that 1021 contains. Instead, it simply says that the requirement of military detention does not apply to U.S. citizens, but it does not exclude U.S. citizens from the authority, the option to hold them in military custody. Here is what it says. Applicability to United States citizens and lawful residents aliens. United States citizens, the requirement to detain a person in military custody under this section does not extend to citizens of the United States. The only provision for which U.S. citizens are exempted here is the requirement of military detention. For foreign nationals accused of being members of Al-Qaeda, military detention is mandatory. For U.S. citizens, it is optional. This section does not exempt U.S. citizens from the presidential power of military detention, only from the requirement of military detention. In other words,
he can say, you know, he can waive that at any time.
Yeah.
But he can say, no, forget it, you're military detention.
The most important point on this issue is the same as underscored in the prior two points. The compromise reached by Congress includes language preserving the status quo. That's because the Obama administration already argues that the original 2001 AUMF authorizes them to act against U.S. citizens if they believe they have the power to target U.S. citizens for assassination, then they believe they have the power to detain U.S. citizens as enemy combatants. The proof that the bill does not expressly exempt U.S. citizens or those captured on U.S. soil is that amendments offered by Senator Feinstein providing expressly for those exemptions were rejected. The compromise was to preserve the status quo by including the provision that the bill is not intended to alter it with regard to American citizens. But that's because proponents of broad definition powers are confident that the status quo already permits such detention. In sum, there is simply no question that the bill codifies indefinite detention without trial. That's myth one. So you know, there is no question that it significantly expands the statutory definition of the war on terror and those who can be targeted as part of it. Myth two. The issue of application to U.S. citizens, myth three, is purposely muddled. That's why Feinstein's amendments were rejected, and there is consequently, no doubt the bill can and will be used by the U.S. government under this president or a future one to bolster its argument that is empowered to indefinitely detain even U.S. citizens without trial. This legislation could also give future presidents the authority to throw American citizens into prison for life without charges or a trial. This bill also contains misguided provisions that, in the name of fighting terrorism, essentially authorize the indefinite imprisonment of American citizens without charges. Even if it were true that this bill changes nothing when compared to how the executive branch has been interpreting and executive and exercising the powers of the old AUMF, there are serious dangers and harms from having Congress, with bipartisan sponsors, a Democratic Senate, and a GOP House, put its institutional, statutory weight behind powers previously claimed and seized by the president alone. That codification entrenches these powers. As the New York Times editorial put it, the bill contains terrible new measures that will make indefinite detention and military trials a permanent part of American law. What's particularly ironic and revealing about all this is that former White House counsel Greg Crane assured the New Yorker's Jane Meyer back in February 2009 that it's hard to imagine Barack Obama as the first president of the United States to introduce a preventive detention law. 4 months later, President Obama proposed exactly such a law, one that the New York Times described as a departure from this way this country sees itself, as a place where people in the grip of government either face criminal charges or walk free. And now he will sign such a scheme into law.
Folks, it's kind of scary, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's the extent of it. Of course, you know, a mainstream media, which I watch, there's no mention of this.
Well, the New York Times wrote about it.
Yeah, but there was no mention of it on the national news.
Mm-mm.
Okay, which I thought was kind of like,
Not a word.
Oh, here's something interesting. I thought it was kind of cool. Gaddafi, smoking gun. This is from the smoking gun. Gaddafi was to receive the UN Human Rights Award. This is an Olivia Free Press. Before NATO and the U.S. started bombing Libya, the United Nations was preparing to bestow an award on Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, the Libyan Jamaharaya, for its achievements in the area of human human rights. This is funny. I say this because this is not a joke.
It's remarkable.
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
So, this is from Libyan Free Press. Let's see what that says. I read it there.
Before NATO and the U.S. started bombing Libya, the United Nations was preparing to bestow an award on Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and the Libyan Jamaharaya for its achievements in the area of human rights. That's right. The same man, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, that NATO and the United States have been telling us for months was a brutal dictator, was set to be given an award for human rights record in Libya. How strange it is that the United Nations was set to bestow a human rights award on a brutal dictator at the end of March.
Reports in a working group in Libya. So I asked the question, who is this brutal dictator that the United Nations General Assembly of Human Rights was preparing to bestow an award to for human rights sometime at the end of March, so they would have us believe that they knew that he was a brutal dictator, yet decided to give him an award for human rights. Astounding. Astounding, the lies that were being told by the media, NATO, and the U.S. government. Absolutely astounding, as the reporter writing. Not surprising, but astounding. But more astounding still is the fact that time after time after time, much of the American public, without questioning, believes every single word that comes from the news media. It is noteworthy to read the following couple of sentences from General Assembly's report, and it just says several delegations also noted with appreciation, the country's commitment to upholding human rights on the ground. Additional statements which could not be delivered during the interactive dialogue owing to time constraints, but he posted on the extranet of the Universal Periodic Review when available. All right, so this goes on, but I just thought it'd be fun. And any particular countries listed, present the reader can look at the list and make up his own judgment regarding the credible level.
These are the countries that praised him.
Yeah.
Denmark, China, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain.
Slovenia, Nicaragua, Russia, Spain, Indonesia, Sweden, Norway, Ecuador, Hungary, South Africa, the Philippines, Chile, Maldives, Singapore, Kazakhstan. A lot of these countries have human rights violations against them, too. Nicaragua, Congo, Rwanda, so it's, I don't know. But anyway, it's kind of funny, and maybe the UN is just a big crock of bullshit, too.
I guess they didn't catch up with what was happening.
I guess not. I thought you'd get a kick out of this, Lila. This is very, very funny. Can you read it?
According to the Alaskan Department of Fish and Game, while both male and female reindeer grow antlers in the summer each year, male reindeer drop their antlers at the beginning of winter, usually late November to mid-December. Female reindeer, however, retain their antlers until after they give birth in the spring. Therefore, according to every historical rendition depicting Santa's reindeer, every single one of them, from Rudolph to Blitzen, had to be female. We should have known this. Only women would be able to drag a fat man in a red velvet suit all around the world in one night and not get lost. Very cute.
I thought.
That's very funny.
You know, that had over 10,000 shares.
I can understand why.
It was very funny. And let's see, we got about 3 more minutes here, but I thought this was very, very important. Maybe we can get to some of this tomorrow later. Of course, Romney praised Israel and said Obama wasn't doing enough for Israel. But but anyway, exclusive Romney Family Investment Group partnered with alleged perpetrators of $8 billion Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, I did read a little bit about that.
It's amazing, isn't it? And
that's with his son.
Yeah. And medical journal article. Now, this is quick, and I'm going to read this before we bring George up. This is kind of frightening what this is saying. Medical journal article says 14,000 U.S. deaths are tied to the Fukushima fallout. Washington, December 19th, and this is by PR Newswire, estimated 14,000 excess deaths in the United States are linked to the radioactive fallout from the disaster of the Fukushima nuclear reactors in Japan. According to a major news article on December 2001 edition of the International Journal of Health Services, this is the first peer-reviewed study published by a medical journal documenting the health hazards of Fukushima. Authors Joseph Mangano and Janet Sherman noted that the estimate of 14,000 excess U.S. deaths in the 14 weeks after Fukushima meltdown is comparable to 16,500 excess deaths in the 17 weeks after Chernobyl meltdown, 1986. The rise in reported deaths after Fukushima was largest among U.S. infants under age 1. Mm. The 2010 to 2011 increase for infant deaths at the spring was 1.8 compared to the decrease of 8.37% in the preceding 14 weeks. Just 6 days after the disastrous meltdown struck 4 reactors in Fukushima on March 11th, scientists detected a plume of toxic fallout had arrived over American shores. And subsequent measurements of U.S. Environmental Protection Agency found levels of radiation, air, water, and milk hundreds of times above normal across the U.S. And the highest detected levels of iodine-131 in precipitation in the U.S. were as follows.
Boise, Idaho had the highest.
Yep.
Kansas City.
Salt Lake City, yeah.
Jacksonville, Florida. Olympia, Washington. And Boston, Mass.
And epidemiologist Joseph Mangano said the study of Fukushima health hazard is the first to be published in the scientific journal. It raises concerns and strongly suggests that health studies continue to understand the true impact of Fukushima in Japan and around the world. Findings are more important to the current debate of whether to build new reactors and how long to keep aging ones in operation.
Mm-hmm.
And the article goes on, but we're at 3:30, and just at 8:30, so just to let you know that there's been at least 14,000 excess deaths.
And maybe more.
And maybe more.
Yeah, maybe more. Maybe they haven't counted them all.
Yeah, I mean, it's really sick. It's really a sick thing.
Yeah, I want you to sign into this computer so we have
it. I gotta call Georgie. So I do that right now. Let's see. We got George Dixon coming up in just a second. And
George.
Hi, George. That was quick.
Well, hi. Good evening, Lila. Leo, how you doing?
Good. We're just fine. How are you?
Good, good. I wanted to catch your show from the beginning there, but I got kind of tied up. And, well, good day.
Well,
how you doing?
That's all right. Welcome to the show.
Thank
you. And we're the Tuesday night before Christmas, which is a special time, always. It's a... certainly, this week is very special here in the United States and in the Western world. We celebrate the birth of Jesus. So I thought it would be an important time to talk about that event and its historical significance and its place in history. I mean, certainly it's the birth of a Savior is not a new concept in the world.
No, not at all.
Well, and especially today, we're all hanging on to it. We need a savior. The way the economy is going, and I just heard a new statistic yesterday. It was more than or around 50% of the people in the United States are living on or below the poverty level. That was quite a surprise to me, George.
No, I've seen some of the numbers, and going back 10 years, you know, it's been that way for a while now. You know, people have just been holding their own, but holding their own on elusive money that's not really there. It's debt. It's charging things,
yeah.
You know. And
really. But this is the time of the year when we try to focus on other things and try to have a little joy. So, can you tell us a little bit about the history of the significance of a savior?
Oh, geez, I'm jumping right into that.
We've talked about it before, about how there's many parallels in the Egyptian culture.
Yes, Isis and Osiris. And
right.
The prodigal son was Horus. And
right.
Basically that was the connection to the father himself. Of the God creator.
Right.
And
how that, it really has been passed down from that time. I mean, there's certainly been changes and modifications, but the concept is the same.
Well, yes, the concept is, the salvation. And all three of our religions are that is the focus, salvation. Not only Islamic belief, but also the Old Testament, the Jewish, and of course the Christians, and it's
right.
Salvation in different ways. They're just waiting for it, but it's the same Father. I mean, it's the same family tree. Abraham was the father of all. So basically, it's just three different ways of connecting back with a whole again, and it's through that salvation that we look and sin. Original sin or mortal sin, and a sin is the focus that they use.
So anyway, but it's a strange custom that's been carried over in numerous ways through numerous cultures.
I have my own view of it, I take no academic course other than what I put together myself, and it makes sense to me, but I think it connects a lot of the links that I've found over the years, and it's like the understanding of the Lucifer Rebellion, of how men came here to begin with, or beings. And, I've always said that we are sentinel beings having a human experience, not humans having a spiritual or a sentinel experience. And, we're just going through, an evolution of thought, if you'd want to call it that way. And that thought of that consciousness that we're experiencing is in three-dimensional physical reality. But there are many other dimensions of time and space, and that is what we're experiencing right now, is a three-dimensional physical space. And where can I take this? We see, this is something that we're not locked into. It's just an experience that we've experienced, and it's like you want to experience the life of a consciousness. It's your right or co-creation follow that thought or manifest that consciousness, and without restrictions of where you can and where you cannot go. The only restrictions we have here on Earth, which aren't restrictions, but the polarization of consciousness and of thought that we're locked into, and that is part of the physical reality we're experiencing. But this is just one step on an evolutionary scale, and one part of this evolution that we're experiencing right now is going back within, imploding back into a consciousness of the self, and closing off this period of experience or understanding. Now, when I said this is part of the Luciferian Rebellion, it's the Luciferian in a sense where it's physical, that we're locked into a physical state. But we're not locked into that permanently. This is just a phase that we're experiencing. And part of understanding salvation is that being sentinel beings, at one time, we thought with our hearts or with our soul, not with our mind. And for the last 12,000 years, we were locked out of the emotional body and thrown into the mental state or the linear state. And understanding part of the evolution of time and of experience, going back to the Egyptians, thought was the person who had many names, but Hermes to the Greeks. But what he was able to do was to show us a way that we could learn about the outside world, and that was done by reading and writing and medicine and so forth. That we didn't have the experience or the understanding because we were never open to it. So it was a way for us to open the outside world into the inner world, and that was through the mind. And by looking or living in a linear state, we lock out the emotional state. We don't lock it out completely. But if you take a look at, our upbringing and so forth, we're talked down on using the imagination or going with the heart rather than going with the mind or, with a linear understanding.
Well, I think that carries it into why people celebrate Christmas. It really doesn't have much to do with the mind. It basically deals with emotions. Why people believe or why they want to, you know, it's a giving season and all this kind of thing. I think it's more of an emotional period of time than a intellectual one.
Well, the reason why, Leo, is, you know, understanding this from a paganistic point of view,
right.
is
mm-hmm.
that on a winter solstice, the
right.
The rotation or the wobble of the earth itself actually stops, and it stops for about a day and a half. And understanding that, you know, the earth is spinning around, but it also is wobbling. And what's happening is as it wobbles, the closest, you know, it's just the opposite. The closer we get to the sun in a wobble, the colder it is. The further away we are, the warmer it is. Like we're experiencing now, the sun is off whatever degrees. From the solstice.
Really? Wait a minute. This is winter solstice now.
Right. So what's happening is that the Earth comes to a stop and then goes in the opposite direction again. So that 3 days
yeah.
or that is a time where it actually stops and goes in the opposite direction.
And that'll be happening tomorrow because tomorrow is the 21st.
Well, it's happening right now. It's slowing down. I felt the effects earlier today. And it's actually the slowing down of the wobble. I mean, it's very minute, sensitive. You know, would be able to pick it up. But from an electromagnetic perspective, you know, it affects all electronic fields, electrical fields.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to let's say 1972, that we talked about the last great cataclysm where. The Earth actually stopped and rotated in the opposite direction. And
right.
what it had, yeah, what happened is that the magnetics was just reversed on all those north to south, south to north. And,
well,
isn't
that what's supposed to happen in 212? Is that we're supposed to get a 3-day solar eclipse.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
you know, when the Earth turns around, you know, and. That's what they said will happen. That,
well, that's what they do say, you know.
That's what's predicted.
But every year, I mean, this is a natural phenomenon that we experience. It's
right.
just part of the magnetics of the Earth and the Sun and our solar system. But Leo, what you're saying is right, that the Mayan prophecies talk about a time Hopi also, Hopi Mayan, talk about the time where the Earth will stop and they'll experience either 24 hours of daylight or 24 hours of darkness. And
well, I thought it said 3 days. I thought it's 72 hours. But the thing that always connected, like for instance now, like. The solstice, right, where you have this period, but it relates to the 3 days that Christ was in the tomb, all right, and rose again, and
yeah.
all of this. It plays right into the whole
significance of the legend,
yeah, you know, of
yeah.
Religion, and then again, I don't know. It gives credence, I guess, in some ways to or an explanation to. Biological oddities or natural oddities, but I think the significance that I relate to this more so is how this time, one time every year, the push for brotherhood and loving and the neighbor and
remembering your family,
remembering family and. Being in generosity and remembering those who are less fortunate, and the whole Christian ethos is our pathos, I should say, is the focus of this time of the year.
I'm not finished explaining that, but go ahead. Yes.
Oh no. Okay. But I guess it just always amazed me that we can forget all that over the course of a year. And only to be reminded once every year, you know, of its significance. How does that play into history? Does that that you've seen?
I think that's maybe always, human nature.
Was it always that, or did it just become more so during the Christian era? Or did it always have that kind of significance during the solstice?
Well, it was used, you know, what they did is they took pagan festivals time and used it for their own organized religious needs and wants.
No, I know, but during the winter solstice, that was actually, winter was always seen as the oncoming of death, really, because...
Well, it is, Leo, because the sun or the earth actually stops, then it starts up again.
And it's, I thought it was when the earth was the furthest away from the sun.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought so also. But if you take a look at the star mass and so forth, you know, it's not.
That's why it gets cold,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
well, go ahead.
It's kind of screwy, but, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Finish what you were going to say before Leo had his piece there.
Well, you know, it's understanding the whole concept of religion and even Christianity. It's using that time, for basically the Savior to come and, redeem the world or save the world. And, you know, it's understanding the principle behind the salvation, what you're looking for. And what I was saying before is like 15,000 years ago, is we were thrown into a darkness where we were detached from the outside world. And when I say detached from the outside world, we weren't physically connected, we weren't mentally physically connected with the world other than what we thought we were doing. It's controlling our lives through our mental aspects, our survival instincts. Now, the body itself has a separate body itself, and it is in touch with the outside world, just like your senses are part of your body. What you see, what you hear, what you feel. And it basically is controlled by the heart itself. The heart is a seven-chamber liquid oscillating crystal. And actually, it produces the magnetic field within your body, not your brain. And,
really? I didn't know that.
Yes. And what it does is that it's the signals are sent to different parts of the body. And the brain is just like a computer, has its work to do in maintaining, you know, the life of cells and so forth, and regulates. Lets the cell know when it's time to replace itself and so forth. But that is done basically by the mental body, not the physical body. But my point is that the people were cut out from the outside world because they only could comprehend what they told was out there, where they couldn't actually see it themselves other than they were told what they were seeing, and that's the way things were. Now, part of the problem was we weren't whole. We were like half a person. We were we were experiencing half of the experience on a three-dimensional reality, lifestyle. So what we needed is somebody to go in and break the ice, in a sense, show us that, we are all part of the whole. And that is the unity consciousness understanding that there is a superior God, God himself. But what Christianity has done is given you a savior, a physical savior in a sense, somebody who is physical, just like us, not something, not a light, you know, that resonates the whole universe, but actually a physical being that you can relate to. So understanding that with the three in one is that it's Jesus actually is your connection here to the God himself principle. He is the way to the Father. And it's through the heart of the emotional bodies, that the emotional body itself, that you attach yourself to the Jesus concept for the salvation scenario. You know, the Old Testament talks about, you know, the laws and so forth, and it wasn't through the emotional body until after the Jesus effect. And that was part of the salvation that was part of the following that people had for years. Now, I'm going back, and I've talked years ago about Akhenaten and Queen Nefertiti. And supposedly the prodigal son, like Jesus was King Tut. And, of course, with the politics and the way powers be at the time, you know, it was killed out or it was brought to a close and it didn't happen, you know, because the religious, the controllers of the world, you know, wanted to keep their the control the way they were. And, of course, they didn't want to open up to any other powers of, you know, just one God. They couldn't understand that. But make a long story short, it was Akhenaten and Queen Nefertiti who actually followed this law of one, and they taught the law of one. And after the Akhenaten was out of the picture and Nefertiti was gone, part of different groupings or Jewish groupings broke away, just like the Essenes. And there is beliefs that Mary Magdalene, the mother of Jesus, was a Essene, which was a strict Jewish follower. And,
you know what I read?
That is the basic story. Yeah.
I believe this is true. They called Jesus of Nazareth. There was a Nazarene.
Yeah.
And it turns out there was no Nazareth. There never was. He was an Essene.
Right.
Okay. And that got incorrectly
translated
to a Nazarene, but it's not. It was actually an Essene,
his mother.
And Magdalene was not Magdalene. Mary was an Essene, and so was Joseph. All right. So these are, and that was a special Jewish cult, if you will. They called it a cult back then. That lived a very
strict life,
yeah. Very strictly to the
laws and the
So
anyway, that brings us, George, to today, where we have modern religion.
Yes.
And I think that, as Leo said, at this time of the year, people begin to kind of remember their religion, and they begin to remember the rest of humanity, and there's often a great surge of giving and sharing and that kind of thing. It's too bad we don't have that all year, because it certainly is a great need.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because we have been confined and shielded from so much in our lives that what's happening is the veil has been lifted, and we are experiencing things, you know, that we've never experienced before. And, you know, I got to jump to here, one of the series of Star Trek, where they went to a community where at certain times of year, they call them festive times, where the people would go crazy, let's say for 3 days.
Yeah.
And, you know, the bell would ring, and they all go crazy and drinking and dancing and, you know, just living it up. And after that 3 days, they go back to normal where they're prime and proper. And, you know, they live a very restricted life. But, you know, it's like we have been programmed over the years to, you know, live a certain way. And we haven't been able to be our own captain, if you want to call it that. But, you know, it's with the Mayan calendar, we've been talking about this for a few years, and it's the time of co-creation, where now we can co-create a different life or life the way we want it, you know, not the way other people see it. And that is part of the change in 2012 that we're experiencing right now, that we're seeing.
That's right.
We're seeing the other side of the veil, and there's more to it than blood and guts. There's a lot of love and beauty out there, and all we have to do is tap into it. Just like, you know, we yell about fuel and so forth and the economy, but understand that we have technology now where we don't need money, that, you know, we can live nice and there's a room for everybody, not a certain number, for everybody. And to clean up the environment, I think we have about 80% of the cure that we can put in motion and clean up a lot of this, the waste and so forth. The nuclear energy, you know, the nuclear fission and from these nuclear power plants, that's a different story. But I do believe that there is some kind of saving factor on this. There is an option on this, and all you have to do is tap into that option and put it to work.
I'm sure that's probably true. I'm sure there's all the energy that we could want possible on this earth without causing pollution or costing any money. But you'd have to have the will to get it.
I think it's going to happen, Lila. I really do, because this is a time also that all these drives and thoughts and ambitions that have put in motion are manifesting themselves. Now, when I say, I'm saying that the God of our fathers and all religious beliefs, they're going to happen. They're going to come. They're going to manifest the way people have been looking for, just like the return of Christ for the Christians. Yes, there'll be a return of Christ because it's got to complete itself. Anything and everything has been put in motion, for a year or for 10,000 years. It's going to complete itself. And that's what we're in right now, where, like it or not, we're completing things and we're putting it behind us and we're going forward. That's the scary part, but it's the best part, because we don't have to look at it with fear. We can just...
I wanted to just mention that there is a petition, online petition. Actually, I've been on Facebook for a while. That's where I saw it. Somebody sent it over to me about getting the government, U.S. government, to release the Nikola Tesla's work. Ever since he died, everything was kept secret and put in government secure files, because all of his discoveries, yeah. And one of them...
You don't have to wait for the government to release that stuff, Leo. We have enough information now. It's the same information.
Oh, I know. But they want all of his work released, because what it is that they're most concerned with is to... he invented wireless energy.
He discovered how to tap into it.
He discovered it, yeah. And he discovered how it could be used. And it can't be, you really can't meter it, so you can't really be...
it's free and available.
It's free and available to everybody, right? Yeah. So I believe that's his work on energy, I'm not sure, but that's something that they're trying to get his papers and stuff released, and they've censored all of that for years.
Orgon is more finite than that, yes, but... electromagnetics, without a doubt, yeah.
Yeah, but anyway.
But that would be wonderful, wouldn't it, George?
Well, it would be wonderful, I think, if we could make more of these things, because there are products out there that people have, but they make them so damn expensive to buy. But I think the cost of them are all going to come down real quick, because they're going to have to compete against one another. You have these anti-gravity devices. Then you also have some of these solar collectors you put on your roof. And, years ago, they were like $10,000 for, a series of panels. But, geez, you can get, a series of panels for $5,000, and put it on a damn charge card,
About a year or so ago, I heard that a Stop and Shop was going to experiment with this new energy battery, where they will be able to power.
They did that with the Stop and Shop in Torrington, I think.
They'll be able to power an entire 100,000 square foot store with this one battery. Okay, on this one battery. So they're experimenting with it now to see how it works. If it's but I haven't heard any more about the results. And this came out, sometime early this year. So anyway, we look forward to seeing something on that.
Leo, I like how you have Your special guest is an esoteric researcher, George Dixon.
I like that,
right? Handle, huh, George?
Well,
you could be known as esoteric researcher. That could be your handle.
I've been using that for years for you, George. I thought it was. You like that, or?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, there's so many aspects of this. I wouldn't know where to begin with. But I think Leo, what we're talking about, and I do believe that let's say a year and a half from now, we're going to have vehicles that you don't need wheels. They're going to fly, and I really believe that even the flying vehicles in Star Wars. Remember that? I believe that we have the technology now. Geez, to build nano machines that go in and change the DNA. But I mean, we have the ability and the knowledge, to make these cars that were in Star Wars, or make things in 3D, just like they have a 3D copy machine now that can make make things, a movable gears, an engine, it's all done through the technology that we have. And it's like the replicator in Star Wars and Star Trek. There you go. We have that. We have that technology. And
but I don't think I sent it to you, but this guy sent me over some pictures of the 1940s, late 30s, early 40s,
yeah.
That were colored pictures that were from the Library of Congress released. To think that in this, 70 years, we've gone from horse and buggy, basically, in these old and tough pictures of rural poverty and whatnot, to the technology that we have today, and the amazing things that this country has developed over the last 70 years. It was just amazing to see to compare what we know now and those incredible pictures of back then,
But this is really an incredible time of the year, and we appreciate the historical perspective you gave our listeners, George.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
We are living in a very interesting world right now, and what you're saying is right. The way technology in the last 100 years has gone beyond unbelievable. But we've lived through that. But now we're still finishing it up, and I think in the next couple of years we're going to complete everything. And that's a scary part.
I think so, too.
And we thank you very much for being with us this evening, and I'm sure we'll talk to you before the holiday.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. And you folks have a good night.
You too, George.
Okay, George.
Thanks.
God be watching.
Thanks. Good talking.
And we will be bringing up Woody in the ring here in just 1 second.
We've got to bring up his music.
Thank you, Lila. How's my sound this evening?
Oh, you sound
can
pretty
I
good.
Hear?
Yeah, we can hear you so far.
Great. Well, that's good. I just started, so far it's pretty good then. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, little NBA upgrades in New York, my Stone Cold locks, other football news, and, of course, some baseball. Let's get down to it. New York Knicks make some major upgrades in this short offseason. Madison Square Garden has been renovated as well. So, too, have the New York Knicks. Bad contracts, underachievers, chemistry problems, and roster changes have saddled the Knicks during Mike D'Antoni's first 2 years as coach. The upgrades the Knicks have made in the past 18 months, however, are agreeable to D'Antoni. Now, every time we're shaking things up, it's getting better. I can handle that, he said. It was shaking it up and getting worse. That wasn't good. This is starting to get exciting. It all started with the signing of forward Amari Stoudemire in free agency in 2010 and, of course, acquiring forward Carmelo Anthony from the Denver Nuggets at last season's trade deadline, which led to New York Knicks' first playoff appearance since 2003, which, of course, they lost to the Knicks, lost to the Celtics in four games. But, hey, there was excitement once again in the Garden. Stoudemire and Anthony were the first major pieces part of former general manager Donnie Walsh's legacy. Interim general manager Glenn Grunwald has continued with the addition of free agent center and NBA champion Tyson Chandler, giving the Knicks one of the top front courts in the NBA, or as Anthony says, one of the best on paper anyway. Chandler is a lunch pail kind of guy. He'll come to the game. He'll put his work in. He'll get his rebounds. He'll get his shots. Not a lot of flash, as I said. He's kind of a lunch pail kind of guy, and he plays good defense. So you got to like that because the Knicks don't play a lot of defense. Now, it didn't end with Chandler. The Knicks last week added veteran point guard Mike Bibby, and Monday they signed a one-year deal with veteran point guard Baron Davis, whose back injury, I believe a bulging disc, might keep him sidelined for 2 months. We're good, said Anthony, who at 230 is 6 pounds slimmer than last season. We just have to prove that. But until we actually get that going with Tyson here, communicating, talking, practicing, we shall see. Davis, despite his injury, sees himself fitting in with the D'Antoni's offense, which emphasizes pick and roll. The magic of playing in the Garden and playing with a team like this and with this coach and a system like this is pretty much a no-brainer. Walsh also drafted a surprising guard, Landry Fields, in 2010. Grunwald drafted a guard he expects to contribute this season, Iman Shumpert. As I said, though, Chandler's arrival is probably the biggest thing going for the Knicks. That, and of course, they're in the process of renovating the Garden, and it's going to really be quite a sight. So if you can get out to Madison Square Garden and catch a game, by all means, please do. Now, a little bit on the dark side of all this is that former Lakers and Bulls head coach Phil Jackson is waiting in the wings. If D'Antoni so much as stubs his toe with this team, believe me, Phil Jackson will be the next coach of the New York Knicks, and that's going to happen one way or another. I can guarantee that's going to happen within the next year. You know, D'Antoni's got one more year, and he'll be lucky if he makes it through this year. I don't care how good the Knicks are. As soon as he stubs his toe, believe me, if you can get Phil Jackson in there, Phil Jackson is a kingmaker, and that's exactly what will happen in New York, and that will be kind of cool. Now, don't get me wrong, I hate the Knicks. I'm a Bulls fan, but it will be nice to see basketball good again in New York City. Okay, moving on to my Stone Cold Locks. And let me tell you, the games are really getting harder and harder to pick, so we'll see how it goes this week. Now, one of the big games this weekend is the Jets and the New York Giants. I'll talk a little bit more about that coming up. You know, obviously, it's not much of a home field advantage because, you know, they both play in the same stadium. The Giants are getting 3 points. I'm going to have to take the Giants with the 3 points. I don't think the Jets are going to beat them, so I'm going to take the Giants. You have the Broncos traveling out to see the Buffalo Bills. The Bills are at home. Home team getting points, usually I shy away from. I've said this before. But in this instance, I'm going to take the Broncos. Bills got smashed at home by Miami. Miami doesn't even like playing in the cold. Although the big drawback is, you know, Denver's traveling. You know, when West goes to East, it's very difficult because of the time change, so on and so forth. But the Bills are just doing a lot of losing here towards the end of the season. They're not on fire like they were earlier. And I'm just going to take Denver. Okay. Moving on. Boy, this is a tough game to pick. Patriots are at home against the Dolphins. I can't stand the Patriots or anything New England. But they're giving 10 to the Dolphins. I don't see the Dolphins playing well twice in cold weather. I just don't see it happening. Patriots looked real good out in Denver. So, you know, you got to take the Patriots in this one. The Patriots are really cranking it up. So I'll take the Patriots. So I have the Giants getting three. The Bills, Denver, -3, and the Patriots, -10. So that's how it's looking for this week. Now, I watched a few of the games over this weekend, this past weekend, and what did I see? Well, I watched the New York Giants totally tank it against the Washington Redskins, a game that the Giants badly needed to win, but a lot of people thought they were going to have a tough time winning. A lot of it comes down to the Giants' defense. Rex Grossman is just not that good, and he was really carving up the Giants for a good number of yards. Just made the Giants look kind of stupid. The Giants came out flat, and they're playing at home. Very difficult to watch. You almost feel badly for Eli Manning because he is out there giving it his all, and he's going to end up throwing for a hell of a lot of yards this year. And, once again, they may not make the playoffs, and I think that'll probably be the end of Tom Coughlin's job. But we'll just have to wait and see. Ownership, he does have ownership in his corner. Another game that was also extremely difficult to watch, and I only watched very little of it, was the Jets-Philadelphia-Eagles game. The J-E-T-S, Jets. Jets got smoked by Philly. And one of the things that was extremely difficult to watch was the Jets captain, who had a couple drop balls, a fumble that was returned for a touchdown. As soon as he makes a touchdown catch, and the Jets are getting smoked at this point, it's like 28-3 or something like that, whatever. End of the first half, and they're really getting pounded. This idiot makes a touchdown catch, puts the ball down, puts his leg, stands up on the ball and flaps his arms like an eagle. I mean, I'm all about celebrating in the end zone. It is a kid's game. It's still good to have fun. But, you got to pick your moments. And when you're getting smoked in the game that you need to win, that's not the time to taunt the Eagles and flap your arm like an eagle because you made a touchdown, you freaking moron. And to make matters even worse, his coach sat there and defended it, And on top of that, this guy is a captain. Holmes is a captain of the Jets. How you make this guy a captain is beyond me. The Steelers got rid of him to the Jets for a 6th-round draft pick. A guy with an enormous amount of talent is gotten rid of for a draft pick. Now, what does that say? Not very much. So he's not a big-time kind of character guy. And then the Jets go and make him a captain. Boggles the mind. Another rough game to watch. I didn't watch it. I actually listened to it on my Sirius radio in the truck. Was my Chicago Bears getting beat at home by the Seattle Seahawks. The Bears have been extremely tough to watch. Every week, something goes wrong. Our quarterback went down, broken hand. Then we lost our running back. Then one of our special teams guys gets busted by the feds for trying to be a cocaine kingpin in Chicago. And then we lose Johnny Knox, one of our best receivers this past weekend. I mean, it's just been a real brutal second half of the season for the Bears, who looked like a team in the NFC that was going to challenge the Green Bay Packers. But they've just lost so many games in a row, and just so many things have gone wrong. And the games are tough to watch. And, the quarterback choice that they went with, Caleb Haney, the backup, it's just been absolutely horrendous. I said when Cutler went down that we needed a veteran guy to go in there. I certainly didn't want Brett Favre, but I would have taken the guy up in Minnesota, the former Philadelphia Eagle quarterback, the black guy. I'm sorry, his name eludes me at the time. But I certainly would have went for a quarterback like that, Donovan McNabb, and they're stuck with this guy, Caleb Haney, and thank God his contract is gone next year, because do not bring him back. He is just absolutely horrendous. We did see glimpses of, a little bit of brilliance when he filled in for Cutler in the second half of the Green Bay Packer game last year, but it's just not there. I mean, he just looks overmatched. Now, speaking of overmatched, there's some big game going on this week. It's the Giants and the Jets. Now, Rex Ryan, he likes to talk about winning Super Bowl championships, but this week he's focused on winning the city championship. The Jets and Giants meet Saturday afternoon at the MetLife Stadium, and the Jets coach wanted, we wasted no time launching the trash talk. I recognize that they're an excellent football team, but I think we're better, Ryan said on a conference call. Giants linebacker Matthias Ginola fired back during his conference call with the media. I know we're a better team. We just have to go out and prove it. Of course, neither team looked that terrific. You know, at the moment, after the weekend, both are coming off embarrassing losses on Sunday. You know, the Jets, you know, getting stomped 45-19, and they're 8-6. And the Giants, you know, they got beat 22-10 by the lowly Redskins. But, the loss, you know, certainly didn't humble Ryan. He came out firing when asked about his crosstown rivals. Ryan wrote in his book, Play Like You Mean It, that the Jets were the big brothers to the Giants in New York. He did not back down from that. Quite honestly, I never came here to be a little brother to anybody, Ryan said. So it's on. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of talk going on back and forth, and it's definitely on. Should be a good game. I frankly think the Giants, you know, if they play up to their capability, they're a better team than the Jets are. But that remains to be seen. But I think it's going to be a good game. Going to be a lot of hard hits and stuff and some, you know, maybe some good defense. We'll have to see about that. But, yeah, that's going to be a good game. Also, the Bears play the Packers. That would have been a good game. The Bears are probably going to get smoked and it'll probably be unwatchable. All right. Moving on to some baseball stuff. When Jimmy Rollins had a chance to go somewhere else, he just couldn't walk away from the Philadelphia Phillies. The all-star shortstop got a 3-year, $33 million deal. The smooth-talking, slick-feeling shortstop has spent nearly half his life with the same organization. Good for him. So he turned down more money from the Milwaukee Brewers to stay with the Phillies. Rollins and the Phillies finalized that three-year, $30 million contract on Monday. The deal includes a vesting option for a fourth year at $11 million. If not vested, the club option at $8 million or a player option at $5 million. Pretty good money. you have to take everything into consideration when you've been somewhere since you were 17, Rollins said. To go somewhere new with this part of my career, you feel like a running player because you weren't part of the process from building the team up. You really got to like that, hearing that from these guys. From the first day I got here in the big leagues, it was about making this team a contender and then a champion. So those things have been accomplished. The champion part, not as often as I would have liked, said Rollins. Obviously, when the money is on the table and it's guaranteed, it's tempting. But you think everything else that you've done and what you'll be able to do going forward and where it makes sense for you to do those things. Rollins, a three-time All-Star and a 2007 National League MVP, is the longest-tenured athlete in Philadelphia, which is one of the toughest sports cities in the world. Christ, they booed Santa Claus. Selected in the second round of the 96 amateur draft, he was a free agent for the first time in his career. Rollins turned 33 last month. He sought a five-year deal. Phillies didn't want to go that far, and Rollins didn't want to leave. And, you know, they reached an agreement last weekend. So good for Rollins. I'm frankly not a big fan of him or anything in Philadelphia, but hey, it's a good story to hear. You know, you got to like that. There's 10 top remaining free agents left. Prince Fielder, he plays first base. He played with the Brewers. The Mariners are thinking about it. You know, it's, you know, the question is whether Scott Boras can be satisfied falling short of an Albert Pujols-type deal. Another big player that's up for grabs, former Met and now a Giant, Carlos Beltran, you know, outfielder. The Cardinals, you know, they show that they're doing something post-pool, so they very may well sign him. Javier Vasquez, former Yankee and a former Marlin, he's looking to probably go to the Royals. Hiroki Kuroda, right-hand pitcher from the Dodgers. He prefers the West Coast, but Yankees just might sign him. Casey Kochman, he'll probably stick with the Rays. Francisco Cordero, probably stick with the Reds. Ryan Matson, he's a Philly. He very well may go to the Red Sox, but you never know. Kosuke Fudome from the Indians, he's an outfielder. He's very good. He might travel out to the Twins. Carlos Pena, first baseman. He's got a big bat. Cubs, he might head off to the Indians. And a former Yankee and MVP, Hideki Matsui, designated hitter. He's at the A's. And probably go to the Orioles with that short porch out there. I'm sure he'll hit a lot of home runs. One interesting thing there in baseball that took place, the Japanese pitcher, Yu Darvish, the deal to negotiate with him, the highest bid, which you have to place with the Japanese team, was placed by the Texas Rangers. Now, they put, I believe, $51 million down, so now they have the right to negotiate a contract with Darvish. They have 30 days. If at that time they're not able to, you know, negotiate the contract, they get their $51 million back, and the guy goes back to Japan, and nothing becomes of it. So that's how it works. When you sign a contract in Japan, you can't leave unless the team gets paid in order for you to leave. So that's how it works. All right. That's it for this week. Shout out to all my wit heads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg, and AFS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, with my partner, Money Mike. I hope everyone has a fun, safe, and family-type Christmas time. That's it for this week. I'll see you next week. Merry Christmas.
Special guest and Woody for his segment on sports, and we'll go back to some headline news.
Yeah, we just got about 8 or 10 minutes left of the show, but I wanted to. There was something I wanted to. Two items I wanted to make seen. One was a light subject, and the other was a heavy subject. But one of the craziest articles I came up with this week was. From Ukraine, it says the U.S. Senate approves bill legalizing soldiers having sex with animals.
Oh, that couldn't be true.
On December 13th, 2011, the United States Senate Thursday, on 12-8, approved a defense authorization bill legalizing sodomy with humans and sex with animals or bestiality. The Senate on Thursday evening voted 93-7 to approve a defense authorization bill that includes a provision which not only repeals the don't ask, don't tell, thing, but, goes one step further, folks. And this is, you can check this out. This is CNSnews.com.
Yes.
And it says here, can I read this? I'll read part of it. Military law on sodomy repeals the military ban on sex with animals and bestiality. On November 15th, the Senate Armed Services Committee had unanimously approved S-1867, the National Defense Authorization Act, which includes a provision to repeal Article 125 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The Uniform Code makes it illegal to engage in both sodomy with humans and sex with animals. In states... it states, any person subject to this chapter engages in unnatural carnal copulation with another person of the same or opposite sex or with any animal is guilty of sodomy. Penetration, however slight, is sufficient to complete the offense. Any person found guilty of sodomy shall be punished as a court-martial may direct. Family Research Council President Tony Perkins said the effort to remove sodomy from the military law stems from liberal Senate Democrats and President Obama's support for removing the military don't ask, don't tell. But it's all about using the military to advance this administration's radical and social agenda, he says. But now that it's passed, however, the Senate version will have to go to a conference committee, and Perkins predicts there will be several striking points with the House. The House, in their version of the defense authorization, reinforced the defense of marriage, saying that there's military don't ask, don't tell as well, prohibiting same-sex marriage on military basis. something the Department of Defense is pushing for, he said. And now this is an added concern that sodomy has been removed. And as we have discovered that bestiality, the prohibition against it has been removed from the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So, yes, the House will have a problem with this bill. As a reader, what do you think about this? I don't know, folks. A lot of strange things happen in war. It's funny. I don't know. The Senate gets silly. So it's okay to have sex with animals in the military. This is Monsanto's Roundup Ready Crops leading to mental illness, obesity, obesity.
Exposing the truth.
Yeah. I'm just going to go to that quick and real brief part of it. And then there's one more that I wanted to get to tonight before we give up the host here.
Exposing the truth info. It seems that good bacteria found in your gut may actually be destroyed with every bite of certain food that you eat. While antibiotics typically hold first prize in depleting the body's gut flora levels, there may be a new culprit looking to take the spotlight, which you may know is genetically modified food. Monsanto's Roundup Ready Crops leading to decreased gut flora. A formula seems to have made to not only ruin the agricultural system, but also compromise the health of millions of people worldwide. With the advent of Monsanto's Roundup Ready Crops, resistant superweeds are taking over farmland and public health is being attacked. These genetically engineered crops are created to withstand large amounts of Monsanto's top-selling herbicide, Roundup. As it turns out, glycophosphate, the active ingredient in Roundup, is actually leaving behind its residue on Roundup-ready crops, causing further potential concern for public health. According to Dr. Don Huber, an expert in certain science fields relating to genetically modified foods, the amount of good bacteria in the gut decreases with the consumption of GMO foods, but this outcome is actually due to the residual glycophosphate in animal feed and food. Dr. Huber states that glycophosphate residues in genetically engineered plants are responsible for a significant reduction in minerals content, causing people to be highly susceptible to pathogens. Although studies have previously found that beneficial bacteria in animals is destroyed thanks to glycophosphate, a stronger connection will need to be made regarding human health for that kind of information to stick. Poor gut flora means poor health. And as awareness grows, more and more people are realizing that poor gut flora often means poor health. Without the proper ratio of good bacteria to bad bacteria, overall health suffers and you could be left feeling depressed. In fact, poor gut health has been directly tied to mental illness, which may explain the influx of people being diagnosed with mental illness. Not only that, but obesity, diabetes, and metabolic syndrome have all been tied to poor gut health.
Interesting. So this genetically modified food.
Oh, it's a killer.
It's been doing terrible things to you. So if you have mental illness, if you're overweight, and if you have diabetes and metabolic syndrome,
chances are
it's caused by what you're eating.
You are what you eat.
You definitely are. Boy, pretty sick stuff. We've got about a minute left, and I think there was one thing I wanted to bring up before we left. Third, 12 top cancer-causing products in the average home.
Oh.
One of them is baby powder.
You're kidding.
Yeah. We may wind up going over the end here, but stick with us. If you can, if you want to call in, you can do that too at 646-915-9505.
And you can hear the show. Otherwise, pick it up on the archive.
You've got about 30 seconds for that. But I wanted to finish off the show tonight with this. 12 cancer-causing products in the average home.
Okay. Cosmetics and personal care products. Talcum powder by Johnson & Johnson.
Ralph Nader, the Cancer Prevention Coalition and Ralph Nader have released a dirty dozen list of consumer products used in most American homes, manufactured by giant U.S. corporations. Cosmetics and personal care. Now, this is sick. Talcum powder.
Johnson & Johnson baby powder. Carcinogenic and risk factor for ovarian cancer and lung irritant. CoverGirl Replenishing Natural Finish Makeup of Foundation, Procter & Gamble. Oh, God, it has all kinds of stuff in it. BHA.
Interacts with nitrates to form carcinogenic nitrosamines. Contaminated with DDT. Contaminated lanolin is contaminated with DDT.
Mm-hmm.
And other pesticides.
Parabens cause contact dermatitis, and fragrances are toxic and cause dermatitis. Oh, listen to this. Crest Tartar Control Toothpaste.
That's for makeup, okay. Crest Tartar Control Toothpaste, Procter & Gamble. God. Ingredients. FD&C Blue Number 1 is carcinogenic. Saccharin, carcinogenic. Fluoride, possibly carcinogenic.
Alberto VO5 Conditioner, Essence of Natural Henna. Formaldehyde is one of its ingredients. That's a carcinogenic. Polysorbate 80, generally contaminated with the carcinogen dioxane. FD&C Red Number 4 is a carcinogenic, and the fragrance is a wide range of undisclosed ingredients and carcinogenic. Clairol, Nice and Easy, Permanent Hair Color.
Quaternium.
Quaternium 15, formaldehyde releaser. Diophyllaminine, DEA, carcinogenic. Thylene diamines, carcinogens. Propylene glycol, dermatitis, and fragrance. You don't know even know what's in there. Also evidence of a causal relations to Hodgkin's lymphoma, multiple myeloma, and other cancers.
Jeez. That's all from Permanent Hair Dye.
Yep.
Yeah, nice and easy.
Ajax Cleanser. That has all kinds. Crystalline silica. It's carbon.
Put out by Colgate Palmolive Toothpaste and Soap Company.
Zud Heavy Duty Cleanser.
Yeah.
Has all kinds in it. Lysol disinfectant.
Carcinogenic, yeah.
Lysol disinfectant spray. Zodiac Cat and Dog Flea Collar. Ortho Weed Be Gone Lawn Weed Killer by Monsanto. Well, anything by them.
Oh, no.
Beef Frankfurters by Oscar Mayer.
Unlabeled toxic ingredients. Carcinogenic. Benzene hexachloride. This is in beef franks. I had some of those this summer, too, and I probably a cancer run.
Daxol.
It's just part. Now, these are all in the hot dogs, guys.
Yeah.
Benzene hexachloride, carcinogenic. Daxol, carcinogenic, can be contained with dioxin. Contaminated with dioxin, irritant, strong sensitizer. Carcinogenic
dieldrin.
Carcinogenic and xenoestrogen.
DDT. Well, we know
carcinogenic
that.
And xenoestrogen. Heptachlor. Holy crap, all this stuff is in that?
Mm-hmm.
Holy crap. The only thing I knew that was terrible for you was the nitrates.
And the hexachlorobenzene and lidane, hormones.
Oh, check this.
And antibiotics.
Yeah, but labeled ingredients. Now, these are unlabeled ingredients that we just mentioned, right? But labeled ingredients are nitrates. Interact with meat amines to form carcinogenic nitrosamines, which are a major risk factor for childhood cancers.
Oh, my God. All
of this shit. Yeah, and Oscar Mayer wieners are marketed to kids.
Those are in Oscar Mayer's,
yeah.
And whole milk, Borden or Lucerne.
Wow.
I never heard of that. That's good
enough. It's done by Borden or Lucerne, a company. Toxic ingredients, DDT. Belgium, hexachlor. That stuff is the same thing that was in the hot dog.
Hexachlorobenzene and antibiotics.
Unlabeled toxic ingredients in milk.
And recombinant bovine growth hormones.
Right. Now, this is in Tuscan milk. T-U-S-K-O-N-K-A-N.
I've never even heard of it. Or
no.
Borden. Or Lucerne.
Yeah, it's either under Borden or Lucerne, I think.
Yeah.
Tuscan milk.
What is particularly galling about the Dirty Dozen, emphasizes Ralph Nader, is that these toxic chemicals don't have to be there. Yet these corporations continue to expose people to health hazards unnecessarily. Current product labeling provides no warning for cancer or other chronic health risks. Food is labeled for cholesterol, but not for carcinogens. Cosmetics are labeled for major ingredients, but not for those that form carcinogens or contain carcinogenic contaminants. Except for pesticides, wholesale products contain no information on the ingredients. Cancer rates are skyrocketing. Currently, more than one-third of all of us will develop cancer in our lifetime, and one-fourth will die from the disease. Many cancers are due to avoidable exposures due to industrial carcinogens in the food we eat and the cosmetics and wholesale products we use.
For more information, see Steinman D. and Epstein SS, Safe Shopper Bible, Macmillan, 1995. It goes on. Hopefully it has gotten the message across that just because these products sit on your shelves do not guarantee its safe use. These are 12 of the thousands of products that have been tested alone or in conjunction. We'd like to add one more to this product.
Most brand name laundry detergents. These are loaded with extremely toxic chemicals not legally required to be placed on their labels that could harm you, your family, and the environment. Residues of these chemicals are left on your clothes and are absorbed by your skin and evaporated in the air where they can be breathed in.
Yeesh.
Oh, God.
If you have allergies, if you want to be sure that your laundry is non-toxic and safe as possible, check out 100% green and residue-free alternative to laundry detergents. If you have
allergies, asthma, or chemical sensitivities, we strongly urge you to consider Smart Clean. Our effective laundry cleaning product, free of detergents, leaves behind no residue to irritate sensitive skin, plus is free of phosphates, petroleum solvents, chlorine, perfumes, dyes, animal byproducts, and other compounds. It is completely safe and effective for adults, children, and infants.
So there you go, folks.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that's pretty serious stuff.
So without, you don't want to eat? Put on any cosmetics,
well,
or clean your clothes.
I'll never buy it. I don't think I'll ever buy another hot tub.
Uh-oh.
And, again, but definitely don't buy Oscar Mayer's, okay, because that's, no, it causes kids' cancers, for crying out loud, the stuff that's in it. It's sick. And then they advertise it. They promote it to kids.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, who the hell does this stuff? I mean, what? How
those soulless corporations. That's
yeah, and they're giving them the human rights to vote now, folks. So, you know, la-di-da.
Well, we've come to the end of our show.
Unbelievable.
And we certainly want to wish people a happy holiday that's coming
yeah.
up. Is
it will
those
be on
of you,
tomorrow night.
Yeah, yeah, but those
and,
of you who don't hear us tomorrow night or
yeah,
the rest
and,
of the week, we do want to say Merry Christmas and a happy holiday.
Yeah.
So good night, folks.
Good night. Yeah, join us right here tomorrow night as well.